Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guest today is Anchorage kidney disease specialist, Dr. Steve Tucker. Our discussion is going to begin with the function of the kidneys and how this function changes with age. And then after that, we'll tackle some other topics, including hypertension and the causes and treatment of kidney failure. And as always, we'll be here ready to answer your questions. So give us a call at 550-8433. That's 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Tucker is a personal friend. I think this is the third time he's been on Line 1, although we're both old enough not to remember for sure. And he's been at this business for over 30 years. If you've got questions or comments, don't hesitate to give us a call. Again, our local number, 550-8433, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Steve, let's start with the basics again. A lot of people don't even know where the kidneys may be located. So tell us a little bit about where the kidneys are and what in the heck their purpose is.
All right, we can do that. The kidneys are a paired organ, roughly the size of an adult fist. They're located in the back, generally just below the floating ribs behind the abdominal cavity. They're supplied by a single kidney artery most of the time, drained by a single vein. The purpose of the kidneys is of many purposes, predominantly most people associate with filtering your bloodstream of the waste products from what we absorb from our diet. Breakdown of cells and purification of the bloodstream. It also balances our salt and water content of our blood, which must be strictly controlled. It balances our fluid and electrolytes. Things like sodium and potassium, chloride, calcium, and phosphorus are all filtered by the kidney and then processed based upon the body's need. Kidney also serves in other purposes. It's involved with the hormonal system that balances blood pressure. It's a breakdown product for a breakdown station for certain hormones and other products. For example, the kidney is involved with degradation of insulin. It makes a number of hormones. It makes the hormone that tells your bone marrow to make blood cells. So when your kidneys aren't working, patients will get anemic. It also makes the effective form of vitamin D that's involved, as most people know, with calcium and bone health. It, at times, of course, functions to filter and eliminate from your body drugs and the breakdown product of medications. Medications either are degraded by the liver and then excreted in the stool, or they're excreted by the kidneys. This is their predominant function.
You know, the vitamin D issue just jumped into my mind when you were talking about it, and I think many people are well aware that nowadays that foods are not particularly a good source of vitamin D, that primarily ultraviolet radiation is the primary source. But a lot of people don't realize that what happens is the ultraviolet radiations work on some of the fat or cholesterol-like products in our blood, in our skin, and then that product that is made is then activated in the kidney to the active ingredient.
Correct. It goes through a number of other metabolic modifications, the liver first, but the very active form of vitamin D, so-called 1,25-dihydroxycholecalciferol, is made by the kidney, and that's involved with calcium balance in the bone and the parathyroid hormones that are in the glands behind the thyroid that regulate how much calcium comes in and out of bone.
You don't do children, so I'm not going to ask you about the changes after birth in renal function, but what about time? Most of our organs seem to deteriorate, slow down a little bit. How about kidney function?
Same, but in a perhaps a slightly more complicated way. The kidneys are one of the few organs that if damaged or a kidney is surgically removed, the kidney has the capacity to increase its function. It can increase in size and increase its functionality, and so we have a reserve. So before any changes in kidney function occurs, we first have to use up our reserve, and that's really not a measurable event. generally speaking, rough rule of thumb is after 60, we lose about 1% of kidney function per year. That's assuming there's no other diseases that have affected kidney function prior to that, and it's not a hard and fast rule, just as I mentioned, a general guideline or rule of thumb. So patients who are elderly may in fact have what looks like normal kidney function based upon the substance we use as a marker, the serum creatinine, and then plug that into a formula. But with minor changes in kidney function as we get older, it can have a significant impact on how we metabolize medications and can be responsible for some of the problems that the elderly get into with polypharmacy.
Mm-hmm. And when you were saying that our function is dropping 1% per year after 60, if I recall, that is after you've already used up your reserve somewhere along the line. So we've already, at that age, that reserve that we normally have has already been affected. But what you're saying is there's no real easy way to measure that effect until we really start getting into the losing what we normally would measure. The function.
Correct. There are three major tests we use to kind of assess kidney function. The first is a substance in our blood called the creatinine. And the creatinine is simply a breakdown product of muscle. And it's relatively unique in terms of as it flows through the kidney and the filtrate is formed where the kidney takes out the good stuff and puts the bad stuff in and comes out as urine, that the kidney doesn't add or subtract. So relatively speaking, the level of creatinine, the higher the creatinine, the less well your blood is being filtered. The creatinine then is plugged into a formula. And the formula takes into account sex, because men tend to have more muscle mass than women. It takes into effect age, because generally speaking, younger people have more muscle mass than older people. And it takes into account race, since African Americans have more muscle mass in general than do Caucasians or other races. When I use percent of function, we lose 1% per year. It's really a more complicated term called the glomerular filtration rate. Most people, including me at times, has a hard time wrapping your head around that concept. So I simply, for the sake of discussion with my patients, translate that into a percentage of function. But really, it's the creatinine clearance that is how much creatinine per minute is cleared by your kidneys, or the GFR, which is another way of measuring that.
And that creatinine is one of those tests on that conglomeration of chemistry tests that are often done on physicals or at other times?
Frequently. I did sort of allude to the three tests that sometimes can point toward a kidney problem. One is the creatinine. The other is the presence of protein or microalbumin in the urine. And the third is blood pressure. Generally speaking, when kidney function becomes abnormal for a variety of reasons, one of the first signs of that is the development of hypertension. One of the good things about kidney disease, and it's also its Achilles heel, is it's asymptomatic, meaning you can have dramatic deterioration of kidney function, be totally unaware that that's occurring until you begin to feel poorly, and then a series of blood tests that you alluded to are obtained and show that the kidneys are in an advanced state of deterioration. Mm-hmm. So the good news is you don't get sick, but the bad news is oftentimes we don't find out about things until very late in the game.
Mm-hmm. So the creatinine is a measure of the function of that filtering system, the glomerulus, which I'm going to ask you to define a little bit more. And then the other way we look at things that you mentioned was protein in the urine, which is looks at a little bit different issue perhaps as well. So tell us about those two things.
Okay. The way the kidney, in each kidney, we have a little tuft of capillaries called the glomerulus. And the glomerulus, as I say, is a group of capillaries to which the blood flows in and then obviously will flow out the other side. But during the course of that transition, a filtrate is formed. A filtrate is the serum of the blood that comes through the membrane of this glomerulus that separates the blood compartment from the urine compartment. So this little tuft of capillaries sits above something called a tubule. And if you could picture it, it's just a hollow tube that sits underneath this to catch the filtrate that's formed as the blood flows through your kidney. And then as the filtrate flows through this tubule, there are active processes to take out extra salt, extra water, and as mentioned, there's calcium exchange systems and phosphorus exchange systems, etc., so that what comes out at the end is urine. That is the waste products, extra salt, extra fluid, extra elements that we don't want. In each kidney, there are roughly a million of these glomeruli. These glomeruli, as mentioned, separate the blood compartment from the urine compartment. And if there is damage to that membrane, one of the first things we begin to notice is protein, which is normally in the blood, begins to leak into the urine. We call that microalbuminuria, which is by definition less than 300 micrograms of protein. As the damage increases and the membrane of this glomerulus becomes more porous, more protein will leak into the blood compartment, and therefore the worse the proteinuria, the worse the kidney injury. And protein itself can be toxic, as it generally is not present in the tubule, and so it can be an irritant and with time can damage the tubules as well.
That's a very good description, Steve. And incidentally, it makes me remember that for those of you who are listening and would like to see a little bit more vivid detail about kidney function, I did put a link on our website, alaskapublic.org, to a short video that I captured off of YouTube that describes some kidney function. There's a couple other links as well, but go to alaskapublic.org, the Line 1 connection for today's program with Dr. Tucker, if you're really interested in seeing more about how the kidneys work. So just to follow this analogy a little bit more through a different disease, as creatinine is cleared through these glomeruli, the glomeruli stop working so well, the creatinine level goes up in our bloodstream, which is a measure of poor function of the kidneys. Now, with diabetes, we've got a little bit different issue, but the kidneys come into play in a couple of ways. And one of the things, we've got too much glucose coming around to those glomeruli, and they kind of, in my understanding, spill out into the urine. It's kind of like there's a dam, and a certain level gets too high, and it goes out into the urine, and we can't pee out molasses, and so we take a lot of water with us, and that leads to some of the common symptoms of diabetes.
Yes, to some degree. Okay. Diabetes, as most listeners I'm sure know, is by far the leading cause of kidney failure in the United States, and for that matter, the world. I would say roughly 45 to 50% of patients who are on dialysis have diabetes as the cause. One of the peculiarities of diabetes is in the beginning, and the time frame does vary from type 1 diabetes, that is people who have no insulin, versus type 2 diabetes, where there is insulin resistance or relative lack of insulin. What happens first with hyperglycemia is there is actually an increase of blood flow to the glomeruli, so-called hyperperfusion. So if we were to measure the creatinine clearance or the eGFR, it would actually be supranormal, that is higher than pick 100%. There's an increased flow. With that, we think that creates so-called hyperperfusion or barotrauma to the glomeruli. Picture a river that's got water in it, and as the water is flowing through, if we increase the amount of water that's coming into that river, it will cause more damage to the banks,
right,
and
right,
cause erosion and damage. And so with time after this hyperperfusion, there's begin damage, and the time frame or the unfolding of diabetic kidney disease is first because then of this hyperperfusion. We then begin to leak some protein because the membrane or the banks of this glomeruli is damaged. So we begin to see some microscopic amounts of protein in the urine, which increases as this injury increases. Then we will oftentimes see a gradual loss of the residual function, resulting then in a rise in BUN and creatinine. BUN is another measurement of kidney function, not as accurate or as useful as creatinine. And then with time, we then develop hypertension because the kidney can no longer get rid of the extra salt and water, and there's derangements of the system, the angiotensin-renin system. in terms of creating hypertension, which then accelerates the damage. If we can catch diabetic nephropathy or diabetic kidney disease early during this super clearance phase, we think we may be able to abort or prevent the development of diabetic kidney disease. And involved in that then is good control of your diabetes, which starts with diet and other oral or insulin medications, again, targeting a substance we call hemoglobin A1C, which gives us a better idea of diabetic control over several months as opposed to what it is right now. Excuse me. Likewise, there are a group of medications called ACE inhibitors, or angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, and a second class called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs, and a third class we don't use very much, an anti-renin medication, alters the way blood flows through the kidney and can dampen this hyperperfusion early in the game by affecting the pressures on the blood vessel to the glomerulus that comes into the kidney and the pressure on the outside, affecting then the intraglomerular pressure. As you might expect, if you increase the pressure on the outflow, then inside the glomerulus there'll be an increased pressure. If you decrease it, there'll be a decreased pressure, and ditto, if you increase the pressure coming into the kidneys, there's less pressure, and if you dilate it, there's more. And the angiotensin renin medications will interfere with that and change the pressures and therefore affect the intraglomerular pressure and decrease the damage.
All right. So let's focus on this because this is new to me and I want to make sure that everybody understands. So what I'm hearing you say is that particularly early in diabetes, there is increased blood flow through the kidneys and the glomerulus in particular, which causes its own damage. In diabetes, if we control the glucose level, then we're less likely to get this increased blood flow. And if we're monitoring renal function with this microalbumin or microprotein test, we can see it coming. And we now have the equipment that appears to prevent one of the commonest causes of chronic renal disease.
May be able to prevent.
All right, so that's one of those long-term questions that's going to take a long time to answer.
Again, if you have someone who is able to maintain superb blood sugar control, which is very difficult, even in this age of new modern medications and all the public awareness and diets and the value of exercise and all these other non-pharmacologic measures, nonetheless, there remains an abnormality, particularly in type 2 diabetes, with this insulin resistance. And so you have some people feel that insulin may be a renal toxin. So that it's not perfect, but it's certainly, even in my short duration as a physician, we have seen a dramatic change in the time that we first discover diabetic kidney disease to the time that they're on dialysis or need a transplant. Used to be pretty predictable, 5 to 7 years after you first detected protein in the urine, these patients would be reaching end-stage kidney disease, that is, a point where they needed some form of renal replacement therapy like dialysis or like a transplant to prevent getting sick.
So, yeah, that is a question I had later is has the advances in the management of diabetes improved outcome, renal disease outcome in diabetics? And the answer is it appears that with better control and better management, that is happening.
To some degree, yes. Yeah. And in addition, we are delaying the development of, and we have, fortunately, a number of other medications and things that can address some of the other issues. Some of the medications will also decrease the amount of protein in the urine. And as I mentioned earlier, protein itself can cause progressive kidney damage. And some of the medications will reduce the amount of proteinuria, which also helps protect the kidneys. Now, one of the things I didn't mention, and maybe I should, is if we took the kidney and cut it in half, there are two layers to the kidney. The outer layer, it's three-dimensional, it's called the cortex, and it's about a centimeter to a centimeter and a half thick. In that resides the glomeruli. The tubules dip down into the center of the kidney, what we call the medulla. And inside the medulla, there's a different process that goes on, and there are tubular functions, and there are certain diseases that will predominantly affect the glomeruli, and certain disease processes that will affect predominantly the tubules, and in the end, generally speaking, both get affected. So we have some predominantly glomerular diseases and some predominant tubular diseases that some people call interstitial diseases inside the kidney itself.
And tubular diseases may not be picked up by creatinine or glomerular filtration rate.
If there's tubular damage that you cannot form the filtrate and flow through the tubule to produce urine, it can result in a rise in creatinine. That is lead to the development of kidney failure. The difference is we don't see the amount of proteinuria that we do in glomerular diseases because, again, the glomerulus is intact and keeps the protein where it should be, which is in the blood compartment. When you have tubular atrophy or tubular destruction, usually then the glomerulus that accompanies that tubule will also begin to die because it has no place for its filtrate to go. So to protect itself, it pressure changes and that glomerular tuft will become atrophic. Blood will stop flowing through it, which creates, again, another set of problems. As each glomerulus drops off, we see that hyperperfusion problem begin. The other glomeruli are asked to increase their workload. They get increased blood flow. And so kidney disease begets kidney disease.
Wow. Very interesting. I've never quite heard it explained that way. And it's very, very easy to understand. Thanks, Steve. We've got a phone call. Let's take this call from Ann. Ann, you're on line one.
Oh, thanks for taking my call, Dr. Woodard. I have a question. I understand that when you have kidney stones, it's passing protein through the kidneys. I had a family member who recently started passing tissue instead of protein. That the tissue was what came back from the lab. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about that and what that might mean. And I'll take my answer out there. Thank you.
Hang on just a second, because I'm not clear to me what the tissue might be. And Steve, the way I'm looking at him, he's not sure either. So we may need some clarification here, Steve.
Oh,
well, let's first talk about the easier part, which is the formation of stones. Stones are just like in old chemistry class or your old chemistry kit are simply crystals, and protein really doesn't have a great deal to do with it. I'll put a little asterisk because it'll just be confusing if I include protein. So protein is generally not part of this, although it may contribute to the nidus, that is the beginning of a stone. But most stones, if we look at stones, and I'm not a stone expert, my colleagues in urology now do most of the stone work, although some nephrologists will still do that, is usually hypersaturation of your urine. Most common stones are what are called calcium oxalate stones. Calcium is in our diet. It's absorbed with the vitamin D, as we talked about. And in people that are prone to stones, there's an extra supersaturation of calcium relative to the amount of urine they're making, and it will crystallize and form a stone. Oxalate, calcium is a positive ion. Oxalate is a common breakdown product of lots of fruits and vegetables and other things that we eat. Positives like negatives, they get married and they form a matrix of a stone. And then depending on what the circumstance is, will increase in size or sometimes pass spontaneously, often with a great deal of discomfort as it rattles down the urinary tract. The treatment, the basic treatment to try to prevent stones, let me back up. Kidney stones are quite common. About 5% of Americans sometime in their lifetime will have a stone. It's a minority of those that go on to have, I shouldn't say minority. About half go on to develop one or more stones, and those are the ones that we focus on to try and see if we can analyze the urine, to see what's in the urine, to see why they are forming stones, and what the type of stone is they're forming. While calcium oxalate is the most common, we have other types of stones, sometimes related to metabolic abnormalities. We can have uric acid stones, a whole bunch of different types of stones that have different etiologies. There's an infection-related stone called struvite stones that form in the presence of altered pH and continuous infection in the kidney. As far as tissue, tissue is very unusual to see in the urine. It can happen if we have certain circumstances where the papilla, and we didn't go into this when I talked about how urine is made. These little tubules will form together in increasing small rivulets, just like little streams become brooks and brooks become rivers and rivers become bigger rivers. That's where the urine forms. And if there is damage to this area in the medulla of the kidney called the papilla, occasionally there are circumstances where that papilla will die. It looks like a little pyramid where all these tubules stick in there, and they can pass into the urine, can mimic a stone because they can cause increased pressure in the ureter as it's trying to push this tissue down into the bladder, and usually represents a fairly significant problem that we call papillary necrosis. We used to see a lot of it in the old days because phenacetin, which was part of a pain powder like Goody's headache powder in the South, used to have a lot of phenacetin and other ingredients that led to a decrease in blood flow to this little highly susceptible area of the kidney called the papilla. And that papilla, if it dies, sloughs and will come out in the urine. We also have other things in the urine that are not necessarily pathologic. We can see what are called casts. Casts are simply a highlight or an outline of the tubule. Sometimes it's because of protein that is normally formed to protect the lining of the tubule from the acidity of the urine, and it will come out, and we call those hyaline casts. But you can also have other types of casts, cellular casts that involve pus cells or white cells or red cells called red cell casts, or hemoglobin, which is the molecule that carries oxygen, can form a cast called a hemoglobin cast, and they can come out in the urine. We can see crystals without necessarily kidney stones in the urine. And so looking at the urine under the microscope ends up being one of the things we often do to help us give a better idea of what's going on in the kidney. I'm not sure if that totally answers your question, but if someone is told they have tissue in their urine, that really necessitates a workup that shouldn't be delayed. It's not normal.
Okay, and it was an instance where it could have happened once. The second time that it happened, the specimen actually was collected by one of my family members, and then it was sent off, and it came back that it was tissue. And so I believe they're in the workup stage now. So it sounds like that's the right thing to be happening.
Correct. Okay. People are there. We can infer a great deal from looking at the urine. And so tissue is pretty nonspecific. Again, depending whether it's a male or a female, female's anatomy, in my opinion, wasn't designed that well. And so you can have cells and tissue from the vagina. You can have, if there's irritation to the bladder and you're shedding some, if you had a tumor, for example, and the tumor becomes necrotic, you can pass that in the urine. So tissue is a pretty nonspecific term that needs to be kind of coned down to determine what exactly it is.
Okay. All right. Well, that is very helpful. So thank you very much for taking my call.
Thanks for your call, Ann. All right. We have passed 30 minutes very, very rapidly here. And what I want to do is take our normal break. Remind everybody you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest is Dr. Steve Tucker, a nephrologist, kidney specialist here in Anchorage. If you've got questions, our local number is 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5552. 5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is kidney disease, and our guest is a kidney specialist, Dr. Steve Tucker, who's practiced here in Anchorage for over 30 years. You can email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us directly at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8, that's a taped rebroadcast, and we can't help you. You can always go to alaskapublic.org, click on the Line 1 link, and listen to any program at any time at your convenience if you'd like to, or refer someone to that number or to that particular program you wanted to hear. And before I move on, I did promise that I would let people know that there is still a lot of questions about individuals who are looking for care, who have Medicare and are looking for primary physicians who will see them. There's an organization called the Anchorage Faith and Action Congregations Together that is sponsoring a series of get-togethers for people who have questions about getting primary care, and they are going to be meeting at various churches in town in a sequential group of days. The next time this organization is going to have a sponsor one of these talks will be Tuesday, February 5th. That's tomorrow night at 5:30 to 6:30 at the Central Lutheran Church. On Sunday, the 17th of February, they'll be at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton from 1:30 to 2:30. I'll try to remember to do the same broadcast again next week, or recommend a reminder about these programs. Steve, a couple of questions. There looks like there's a phone call, and then I have an email on gout. And the question is, please discuss the effect of gout on kidney function. Those of us who are trying to control our disease by diet alone, as well as those who are taking treatments such as allopurinol and are no longer having flare-ups. Is the lack of flare-ups an indication that gout is controlled, or can things be happening that aren't readily evident?
Well, those are good questions. Gout, for just basic review, is a form of arthritis. It's a crystalline arthritis where a crystal called uric acid, which is a breakdown product of purines or proteins, for whatever reason gets into our joint space and elicits a very potent inflammatory response characterized by significant pain, redness, and swelling, as well as tenderness. Most common joint affected is the great toe at the metatarsal phalangeal joint. There are certain lifestyles that are more prone to develop gout. We typically associate that it's more common in men. It's more common in overweight men. It's more common in men that like alcohol. The kidney is involved, sort of, and in a controversial way. This has been discussed now for decades, since I was a student back in medical school 40 years ago. But uric acid, as outlined, is formed from the breakdown of purines and other protein moieties by an enzyme. And in certain folks, under the right circumstance, this gets into the joint space and causes the reaction that I talked about. There are huge numbers of patients that have elevations in their serum uric acid level, but never have gout. We call that asymptomatic, that is no symptoms, asymptomatic hyperuricemia. Hyper meaning more, uricemia meaning uric acid. Uric acid can, under certain circumstances, rare circumstances, as outlined, can cause stones. If there's an overproduction of uric acid and it gets into your urine and the urine pH is such and the concentration of uric acid is such, we can form uric acid stones. That can cause damage by causing blockage, infection, and can lead to kidney damage. Not terribly common. The other type of uric acid problems is something we call acute urate nephropathy or acute urate disease. We see that sometimes in the when patients with usually blood type of malignancies like leukemias, lymphomas, when they're treated and a huge amount of damage occurs to this tissue, this lymphoma, releasing uric acid into the bloodstream, and it can precipitate in the kidney, usually in the interstitium, causing an acute allergic phenomenon. It can also cause blockage and obstruction, and that can lead to kidney damage that oftentimes will get better, and we have some preventative ways to try and prevent that from occurring. Whether or not uric acid contributes to the development of kidney disease, as I outlined, is hotly controversial. There are some people that believe that elevated levels of uric acid can precipitate in the kidney and can contribute to kidney deterioration and may be part of what's involved with, for example, hypertensive kidney disease. Highly, highly, highly controversial. Most people, including me, think that elevated uric acid level is a subtle indication that there might be some underlying kidney damage, is more of a marker of a problem than a cause of a problem. I don't know if that helps. There are very common for people to have an episode of gout. We usually treat the episode itself, and there are multiple ways to treat that. And I won't go into the most common is non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. We can use a new form of colchicine. Occasionally we need steroids in certain circumstances. When gout becomes frequent defined as more than 2 to 3 episodes per year, or is polyarticular, meaning it affects more than one joint at the same time, then oftentimes we'll put people on therapy to try and prevent gout from occurring. The most common group of medicines now interfere with the production of uric acid rather than increase the amount of uric acid that comes out in the urine. The most common of which was already mentioned, allopurinol, and there's a newer medication, febuxostat or Uloric, that is also on the market that also works in a similar way to lower the uric acid level, and when it's below 6, we can oftentimes prevent gout from occurring at all. They can also be used to treat uric acid stones and prevent urate nephropathy. The problem with allopurinol, which is first-line therapy, is that in full 5 to 8% of patients, they can develop an allergic hypersensitivity kind of reaction, which requires us to shift to Uloric. Before, we had really not many other choices. And that's been a nice addition to the armamentarium. But otherwise, they're quite effective. They're ordered in low dose. We then titrate the dose to the level of uric acid, and as outlined, generally when it's below 6, and my rheumatologic colleagues are more of an expert on this than I, we oftentimes will not see recurrent gout, which can destroy joints. And it's more of a joint problem than it is a kidney problem.
Okay. Matt, you're on line one. Thanks for holding on. What can we do for you?
Hi, Dr. Woodard. I was just curious, and I probably could have discerned some of this had I caught the full discussion of renal diseases earlier and progression of, like, the tissue failures. But is there a normal range of, protein in the urine, or does any protein in the urine always indicate some form of renal failure or disease?
Okay, good question.
An excellent question. There is a protein that's produced in small amounts by the kidney itself as mentioned before, to try to prevent the protect the tubule from the acidity and damage from urine itself. It's called the TAM horsefall protein. So most laboratories would consider less than 150 milligrams per day of protein, quote, normal, end quote. As damage worsens, we then grade the proteinuria in terms of its severity. So above 150 is abnormal. Between 151 and 1,000, we call that minimal or mild proteinuria. But again, generally, it will merit some sort of investigation as to why it's there. Then moderate proteinuria is 1,000 to 3,000 milligrams, and above 3,000 milligrams is considered severe and is usually part of a syndrome we call a nephrotic syndrome. You lose enough protein in your urine that the level of protein in your blood goes down, so you get hypoalbuminemia. When the albumin goes down, albumin is what holds fluid in your circulation as opposed to it leaking out into your tissues. And when the albumin level is low, we get edema, which is another part of this syndrome. And if we measure, there is an increase in serum cholesterol and an increase in the amount of fat called lipiduria that we generally don't measure. And that's part of the nephrotic syndrome. Nephrotic syndrome always requires a detailed evaluation. Sometimes we can make the diagnosis clinically, like in diabetes, for example, and other times a kidney biopsy is required to figure out why this patient is dumping this amount of protein in the urine. If it's isolated proteinuria, that is, we're not seeing red cells or other inflammatory cells, then the workup is slightly different and slightly altered in terms of the urgency by which it's evaluated. If the patient's kidney function is normal, they have mild to moderate amounts of proteinuria, oftentimes we'll treat that medically with specific types of medicine to decrease the amount of protein in the urine and only investigate further if the proteinuria worsens or their kidney function worsens. I don't know if that helps. Now, there are other times, if you look at a series, take, for example, hypertension. If you look at patients with hypertension, those with proteinuria, even minimal amounts of proteinuria, seem to do worse in terms of the development of end-organ problems like stroke, heart attack, heart failure, circulation problems, than those that have no proteinuria. If you look at people who are admitted to the intensive care unit with whatever the illness they have, the presence of microalbuminuria is by far and away the most sensitive indicator of whether or not the patient's going to do badly. The more protein that is found on admission to the intensive care unit, regardless of the cause of why they're in the intensive care unit, it's a very poor prognostic finding.
Bet you didn't. Bet you didn't want to know that much about protein.
He asked.
Yeah.
I was just curious as to whether or not it was always an indicator, or if there's some normal range of fluctuation.
Yep. Definitely some normal range.
You can see proteinuria, for example, in fever. It will transiently go up. There's a difference between persistent proteinuria and intermittent proteinuria. And there's also, this may be, again, as Thad pointed out, more than you wanted to know, but there is an entity called benign orthostatic proteinuria, meaning when the patient is supine, they don't have significant amounts of protein in the urine. When they're up and about, they have up to 1,000 milligrams of protein. We think that's because they have, quote, thin basement membranes, and they just leak a little bit when gravity comes into play. And those persons do not go on to develop kidney disease of any kind. It's a benign, incidental finding that becomes important in terms of, say, being rated for insurance premiums and things of this nature, as opposed to pathologic proteinuria, means something's wrong. It just depends on the degree of injury to the glomerular membrane.
Well, if I were to find that I had consistently high amounts of albumin. That's all I know from the tests that I'd taken. And I'd taken them about a month apart. And they were at the same level that they were. Should I just continue to monitor that? And
it depends on what that level is.
Right.
Importance is the degree of proteinuria, whether or not it's orthostatic, and whether it's not it's associated with other phenomenon. But small amounts of protein can be totally normal.
Okay.
Well, I need to add one other thing. There are two types of way we measure proteinuria. One is the qualitative test. That's when you go in and a doctor sticks what's called a dipstick in there that measures pH and the presence of red cells and blood and bilirubin and all kinds of functions, including protein. And the protein is then graded from zero to trace to 4+. What's then needed is to quantitate that protein. In the old days, we did 24-hour urine studies to do that. That is no longer necessary. We can get the same information from a single spot protein sample from your urine, so-called protein-creatinine ratio, to indicate the amount of protein. If you have a small amount of protein and a very concentrated urine, the qualitative test will be very positive. If you have a lot of protein, but you've just guzzled a gallon of water, so your urine is very dilute, then it may obscure the total amount of protein that's present. So a quantitative test is absolutely required if the dipstick is positive above 1+.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're
all
welcome.
All right, Matt. You have a good day. All right, so next is a question that came in before the program, and it goes on the list of, boy, I didn't know that for me. And it's a great question, and I'll tell you my answer, Tom, who sent this in, and then Steve's going to give you the correct answer. Says, I have an observation and a question. When I was snorkeling in Hawaiian waters, I often have to urinate frequently in large volumes, like 6 to 8 times in an hour. What could cause this? My answer, Tom, was the beer you were drinking before you went snorkeling. The correct answer, however, is...
Well, it could be the beer you were drinking, or water, or soda. But in general, when you're in the water, particularly when you're, say, scuba diving as opposed to snorkeling, but can also occur snorkeling, it can occur in the pool, you are relatively weightless. And when you are weightless in space as well, it alters the way urine is produced, and we will excrete more salt and water because we don't need the blood pressure to support our circulation as much, so you will, in fact, urinate more often. I think most of us have noticed that when we swim in a pool. As I told Thad earlier, that's why God invented chlorine, because everybody is peeing in the pool. And it's normal.
I'll be damned. That's my answer to that. Very good. I appreciate the question, and even more, I appreciate the answer. Let's take one more. We have several calls. I'm not going to get to all of them. A couple of emails, but here's one I think addresses a point we just haven't quite addressed yet. And that's an email that asked to discuss the importance of pH balance and the kidney's role.
Well, the body and its cells function best at a pH of 7.40. And there are two ways then that the body will balance pH. One involves our respiratory system, and the other involves the kidney to maintain this pH balance. Our diets are slightly acidic. And so in that respect, we need to manufacture bicarbonate to neutralize this extra acidity. And that's the kidney's predominant function in this area. It will manufacture bicarbonate as needed to keep the pH of the bloodstream normal. Involved in that as well is our respiratory system, which is involved with the excretion of CO2, carbon dioxide, which also goes into bicarbonate formation. So, for example, if our blood is too acidic, one of the first responses will be we will hyperventilate to try and blow off PCO2 to neutralize the pH. The respiratory system can react to changes in pH, and there are a number of things that can do that, which we can mention in a moment, can respond almost instantly to changes in the pH. The kidney, on the other hand, oftentimes will take days to re-equilibrate, to manufacture and adjust the bicarbonate formation to help in this process so that we're not constantly hyperventilating. The kidney will make and manufacture bicarbonate by a complex process in the tubule to help in this process of maintaining normal pH. The most common things that alter our pH, aside from changes in our respiratory rate, are severe infections, for example, that's something we call lactic acidosis, which arises when tissues are not getting enough oxygen and they begin to have an alternate way of metabolism. Diabetics that have poor control, so-called diabetic ketoacidosis, where they begin to manufacture ketones, which are acidic, can affect pH. Certain medications can affect pH. When kidneys are damaged, they cannot manufacture enough bicarbonate. So one of the things that we have to address in people with chronic kidney disease is this so-called acid-base balance, and we may have to supply bicarbonate in the form of medication to, again, to attempt to return the pH of the blood, where cells function better, to their normal range. Shifts in pH can also cause other changes in cellular metabolism. So when there's an increase in hydrogen ions, the body tries to buffer that. It goes inside your cells. When more positive ions go in the cells, then positive ions have to come out of the cells. And that usually is potassium, which can cause a bunch of problems. So that it's a very complex dual system to try and compensate for any changes in pH that arise regardless of the cause.
Okay, thanks. Let's try one more question. We just got about 5 minutes or so. Pauline, you're on line one.
Hi. I have had a chronic bladder infection since I've gone to a lot of the doctors and also a urologist, but every time I get my urine tested, I always have blood cells in my urine, and whether I have an infection or not, I always have blood cells in my urine. So I was wondering, is that anything wrong with my kidneys?
Well, that's a very good question. Number one, when people talk about urine infections, it's a pretty broad category, which ranges from a true kidney infection, which we call pyelonephritis, to a bladder infection, which we call cystitis. And if it's in the urethra, which leads from the bladder to the outside, we call that urethritis. And in any of those conditions, we can sometimes see pus cells, so-called leukocytes, and we can grow bacteria, etc. So we, again, determine the location of a urinary tract infection, often on the basis of symptoms, which I won't go into at the moment. Red cells in the urine, again, as you pointed out, are not normal. But once again, the presence of blood in the urine, we can't generally tell whether they came from the kidney, the ureter, the bladder, the urethra, or for that matter, in men, the tip of the penis. We cannot tell, except in rare circumstances, if we see so-called dysmorphic red cells, which we look at in a phase microscope, or the presence of red cell casts. Either of those two circumstances are more diagnostic of the blood coming from the kidney. When blood is present and we think it's from the kidney, it merits an evaluation. If we think that the blood is coming from somewhere else, say from the bladder, again, depending on age, bladder cancer has to be taken into consideration. It can be seen with infection, but generally goes away when the infection is cleared. We do have some circumstances we call benign persistent hematuria, where the blood cells are there, but we can't figure out why, but generally portends a very benign diagnosis. You can see blood cells in the urine from people that have kidney stones, people that have kidney cysts, people who have kidney cancer. They can be very nonspecific, and depending on the circumstance and the clinical situation, can mean different things. In people over the age of 50, usually means we have to make sure they don't have bladder cancer or kidney cancer. In young women, where kidney infections are very common, then the presence of blood, if we their kidney function is normal, becomes less significant. The whole question of frequent urinary tract infections, particularly lower urinary tract infections, is more in the urologist's range. And there are a number of things that can be done to try and figure out why they're happening and to prevent them from happening. But I got the finger sign from Dr. Woodard that we're running out of time.
Yeah.
So I'll end there.
We've got about a minute. Pauline, do you have another question?
Well, I'm going to a urologist, but, you know, I've been having blood show up in my urine for about almost 10 years. And so my doctors have sent me through all sorts of batteries of tests that always come out normal, but so we still don't know why I have those blood cells in my urine. Even if I don't have an infection, if I have a urine test, that there's still blood. So I'm assuming it's coming from my kidneys. And one of my doctors thought I had a little bit of nephritis, but
it's possible. Now, the one thing, it sounds trivial, is bad things get worse. So having blood in your urine for 10 years is almost testimonial to the fact that you have a benign process. If you had kidney cancer, you'd be dead.
Okay.
Likewise with bladder cancer and things of this nature. Cysts and things would be apparent on a renal sonogram and things of this nature. So it sounds like you have cells, and if you're not having symptoms, and again, I can't take care of you over the phone. That's a key thing to remember. It's probably benign.
Okay. All right, well, I sure appreciate it. I've got doctors working on it, but
good.
Can't figure out what's going on. Thank you.
And that's actually not that unusual to have some fairly benign, low-grade levels of blood in your urine. It's frustrating for physicians and patients alike, I think. Is that true, Steve?
It is. And once you've had a thorough evaluation, usually, again, you can determine whether or not it's going to be persistent and there forever, and it doesn't have to be evaluated every time it's found.
All right. Steve, you know, every once in a while I have a great guest who really helps people listening realize that there is a lot more complexity to medicine than some of us sometimes imagine. And you do a good job of making a very, very complex situation very understandable. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
So if you want to continue this conversation, you can always join us on KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at our website, alaskapublic.org. Next week, well, we haven't discussed painful shoulder problems in several years, so we're going to have Anchorage orthopedic surgeon Dr. Bob Gehringer return, and he's going to discuss the troubles and treatment of this rather unique joint. So why don't you tune into your health and learn more Monday, February 11th from 2 to 3 p.m., repeating the same evening at 7 p.m., right here on FM 91.1 KSKA. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and helped us today on engineering. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.